They're going to arrest them. I hope they do. The only trouble is it may cause a county action.
What'd he do?
He's coming with $1 million to give out to people not to vote. That's an illegal act. Nuts. You're not allowed to bribe people to vote or not to vote. You follow? It's bribery.
I hope they arrest him.
Well, we'll see what happens.
I tried to lynch me, but...
No. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Okay, let's roll. I see our guests from Rehovot are not here. All right. The weather is bad. All right, today's a very fascinating shiur. So last week, first of all, let me give the date. Today is Monday, January 7th, 2013. It's a very, very rainy Monday morning in Yerushalayim, and there's talk of snow later this week, so we're all excited like little children. Be it as it may, we spoke last week about the Ritbaz, and you see, what's fascinating about the Ritbaz, he winds up being smarter than RJJ. Why is he smarter? And this is what I've been told by family members, and I conclude from my research as well. He visited RJJ on basically RJJ's deathbed. He saw what America did to RJJ. When he realized that Chicago is no different than the Lower East Side, he left. Hale, hearty, and healthy, goes to New York, finishes selling off the Yerushalmiyim, and a year later goes in Aliyah and becomes the famous Ritvas of Tzfat. The Machloket in Chicago, and again, I want to stress, it's not that Rabbi Album was a bad person. Chas v'chalila, he was a gadol in learning, he was the childhood chavruta of the Osameach. I told you what the Osameach told Reb Lezer Silva. But you see, kashrut is money. Money is panasa. And Adam need Chazal alei tell us, a person is judged the way he reacts on the three sentences, three different, three different traumas or tension. Kiso, kaso, vakoso. And the truer words were never spoken. When a person gets drunk, the real person comes out. I remember in Lakewood when they got drunk, I believe it was Simchas Torah, not Purim, but could be Purim too, because I went back and forth quite a few times that year. And people cried, sprouted Divrei Torah. When I don't want to use the word BMT boy gets drunk, when a Torah Shraga boy gets drunk, I don't know whether he will sprout Divrei Torah or Divrei Shtut. But you judge a person. Kaso, when a person gets angry, this too reveals the inner person. But above all, when it comes to kiso, to money, what I have seen in life, religious people do for money, it's depressing, it's shocking. And they get involved in machloiket and they don't want to sell, show the knives. But the Ritbaz was smart and he moved on. The chapter of Chicago is basically fascinating for another reason, which I didn't mention last week, because it has little to do with the history of Torah, but it has a lot to do with the history of the Jews in the United States. Most of us take for granted. You have room there? Yeah? Okay. Most of us take for granted that every Jew who came to America made it and was happy here. Nobody went back. So I can tell you that, for instance, if you've studied Washington, I'm only here because my grandfather couldn't go back. He wanted to go back. And I told you, he bought passage, he was lonely, he was all alone, and a week or two before he was to sail, he got a telegram from his parents, "You've been drafted by the Tsar, don't come back, the Russo-Japanese War was on, 1905. This was like 1904, 1905, and my grandfather remained there. Had he not remained, of course, I wouldn't be sitting here, I wouldn't be alive. But he was not happy in the States. And the Ritbaz, here you have a prime example of a great Rav comes to America, gets covered malachim. Everyone defers to the Ritbaz. The Agudat HaRabbanim declares him the elder rabbi of the United States, Sgan Rabbani America, and with it all, he stays barely 2 years, 18 months, two years, let's say, picks up and leaves and moves on to Palestine. So you see, not everyone was overjoyed in the Golden Medina. Now, all these stories and Kashrut and RJJ and the Ritbaz, all these attempts to organize a rabbinate, ultimately had very partial success. What did success and what changed the world, and we're sitting here as a result, all of us in this room, when you organize a yeshiva and train the youth, you change the history of our people. Now, it could be, I apologize to Yoni, it could be I come from a Litvisha background and live a Litvisha lifestyle. But I'm a firm believer that children have a soul. And I've said this, I alluded to it, and all of you that have studied Pashat Bereshit, the Zohar tells us, the Sfarno quotes it, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu built man, he gave him the breath of life. Midilei nafach. He gave him not just the breath of life, there's a divine instinct in every individual. I taught on every level. I began on elementary school. I taught Talmud Torah. I just told Sherry, just now yesterday, to do me a favor to check if someone is sitting shiva, if it's someone who I think it is, and I know him, I want to call to find out, get me a phone number. But I got to be sure it's this person, this Richie Orman. His father-in-law was my principal when I taught Talmud Torah. I told Sherry we had no kollel. In my days, you wanted to get married, you had to go to work. Why you did not support you? And so all of us, by the time we graduated college, my whole chabur, we were all Talmud Torah teachers. You can ask your father. That's the way we all made a living.
He also did it.
Yeah, no, everyone did it. So I taught on elementary school level, then I taught a high school level, then a college level, and of course today postgraduate. But let's talk about elementary. I never met a bad kid. If a kid is not good, it's a sign his parents don't know how to handle him. The Rebbe is not good. There's something in a human being that you strive to be good. Later you're taught to be bad, you're taught to be evil. If you're taught properly, you will taught to be even better. Not just good, but better. And this is what Chinuch is about and Torah is about. And when you begin educating the youth, the world changes. Now, in the Lower East Side of New York, there were Talmud Torahs already. I'll mention the most famous one was Machzikei Hadat. That's the one that he talks about in his book on Jewish education. I'll tell you the book in a minute. And Machzikei Hadat was a fairly good Talmud Torah. But you see, what did the Talmud Torah teach? All right, there was the usual joke. I told you the joke that... did I tell it here? Did I tell it Friday night? I mean, I speak in so many different places. It's hard at times to remember where I told which joke where. But they say it's an anecdote that's true. An anecdote that reflects, as the Rebbe used to say, that this father comes yelling at the Talmud Torah Rebbe, the Malamed, what are you teaching my kid Kaddish for? And the Rebbe says, what am I, dead? And the Rebbe says, don't worry, by the time you die, halavai, he should die to say the Kaddish properly. It'll take another 100 years. So, you know, the Talmud Torah taught a kid a little chumash, Hebrew reading, siddur, prepared him for bar mitzvah. Now, on the east side of New York, there are already parents who were talmidei chacham who would come over here. And, you know, the average person in Europe, again, it's hard for you to conceive of this, but I just heard, and I'm listening in my car to Rabban Soloveitchik speaking. You heard him in the late 1980s. He's giving a talk, two talks on Toru Mater at YU. I find it very fascinating because these are topics I've lectured on extensively, and I'm interested to see what sources we both quote, what we don't quote, what he quotes and I quote, what we don't, that we're not parallel, and how we deal with the Birchat Shmuel, the famous tshuva on secular studies with the Chaim Meisa. So it's really a source of joy for me. Danny and Ellie are full, just look at me, nothing, nowhere else. And it's a source of joy for me to see the way he interprets the Birchat Shmuel, how I did it, etc., etc. So he's talking, when the Voloshin Yeshiva, I'm quoting Rabban Soloveitchik now, I'm quoting family sources. And you know this from my research, when the Voloshin Yeshiva opened, there was a critique against Reb Chaim Voloshin. Why was there a critique? So I mentioned to you 10 years ago when I spoke about, when I lectured on Voloshin Yeshiva, it was revolutionary, it was a chiddush. And people said, I'm quoting Rabbara now, they said to Reb Chaim, what do you need a yeshiva for? Every Beis Medrash kids sit and learn, and kids know Shas and Paiskim, what do we need a yeshiva for? And this was true, this was the lifestyle in Europe. No, I don't want to go into more detail, we certainly needed a yeshiva, the world was changing, enlightenment was breathing down everybody's back, and challenges were on every street corner, it's not the world that used to be. But these people who came to America, even if they were business people, if they were peddlers, even if they have push carts, no matter who they were, those already who were successful, but all of them in Europe learned to a certain degree. They learned so much so that if you're familiar with Rothkopf's work on Revel, on Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel, so you'll see Rothkopf cites sources in the Yiddish press when JTS began, they mock JTS. Why? They say, what is this, a rabbi? He learned 30 daf gemara in a year? In Europe, we used to learn 100 daf gemara a year. And then these were not rabbanim, these were balabatim, criticizing JTS. So you see, they saw their kids going to Talmud Torah, and even Maksike Hadat, and the kids never opened the gemara. They never went further. Now you come, of course, to the heart of what Yiddishkeit is all about.
What did they teach them?
Chumash, a little Navi, Haftorah, Siddur. For an American kid coming in after public school, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you know how alert the kid is. And this is an achievement. If a kid knew Siddur, if a kid, take the kids in Torah Shraka, I guarantee you a high percentage of kids who daven every day, 3 times a day, don't know what they're davening, don't know what the words are, don't know what the order of davening is. You know, all this has to be taught, it has to be taught, and has to be taught properly. But you can teach Siddur, you can teach Chumash, you can teach everything. If you don't master Gemara, you don't know the heart of Judaism. A nice Reform rabbi, a conservative rabbi today, which basically is no different than Reform, everyone knows Chumash. The Reform came out with a Peirush, with a Siddur today, with a Chumash today, with a Peirush. It's beyond words. The conservative have. I don't have to tell you how many the Hirsch Chumash came out in a new edition. But the heart of Torah is Shabbat Peh. As a matter of fact, the whole critique, again, if you recall my lectures on Moses Mendelssohn, I'll just allude to it, that everyone wonders why Mendelssohn's family and friends and children of children and his Talmidim, ultimately 90% leave Yiddishkeit. And obviously the basic reason is enlightenment was shocking, overwhelming. I don't have to go any further than the United States of America. Take the names of 100 great Rabbanim who were in America before World War II and try to see how many of their descendants are still Jewish. I'm talking about great Rabbanim, but and in Europe, I don't have to mention names now. I mentioned names in class, which maybe I shouldn't have, but this is the reality. So one of the reasons you can give with medicine, and this is a side matter, but it's fascinating, because I hold this is not the real reason, but it's complementary. Supplementary is that Mendelssohn stressed the written Torah. He wrote a Perish on the five Chumashim, the Beyur in German, and it's a very logical Perish following the Maran Avuchim, following the Ibn Ezra, but it's not Torah Shebaal Peh. And if you don't write a Perish with Torah Shebaal Peh, with Shas, and with Paiskim, and integrate it like the Malkin did, then you wind up, or like Rav Shimon Shmuel Hirsch did, or like the Ktava HaKabbalah did, so you wind up with a truncated Yiddishkeit. And Josh, this is exactly what happens when you don't learn Torah Shebaal Peh. And Balabatim, one second, Eli, Balabatim were unhappy that when all is said and done, the kids were not getting Gemara. Yes, yes, what did you want to say?
No, I was going to maybe think that there's no, that Pirushim and Chumash, they don't incorporate Torah Shebaal Peh, or not...
No, I'm not criticizing Chas v'Chalila. I'm only saying that people say with Mendelssohn, the emphasis was on Torah Shebichtav. And ultimately, these followers, disciples, children, grandchildren, didn't have the wherewithal to withstand the challenge of modernity. When you have Torah Shebaal Peh, and you have Shas and Paiskim, and you have the total configuration of Yiddishkeit, you're much better prepared. And these Balabatim were upset that even Machzikei Hadat, which was the best of the Talmud Torahs, it was well organized, the teachers were better, they weren't just the Lo Yitzlachnikim, but nevertheless, Gemara, there was no stress, there couldn't be. It was an environment after school, late in the afternoon. You don't remember, you can ask your father. When we taught Talmud Torah late in the afternoon, the greatest challenge was to catch the attention of the children. All right, I have to, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, because I'm a little bit of a born teacher. I always say you can't teach someone how to teach, you can improve his ability, but he has to have that ability. It's inborn. So I used to say, I can tell you kids I taught Talmud Torah who I mamish made from today, their grandparents and endless. And these are kids, you know, typical American homes. But the challenge is there. In 1886, a few of these parents got together and they decided that their children have to learn Shas, must concentrate on Gemara. And they organized a yeshiva katana, which, again, I'm very careful with my words here. We're not certain what the grades were exactly. Logically speaking, it probably paralleled 7th and 8th grades, perhaps some high school grades. It certainly didn't begin all the way with 1st grade. But we call it in popular language the first yeshiva katana organized in the United States. Now, if some half-wit is listening and is going to criticize me, I know that there were attempts in the Spanish-Portuguese time, there were attempts later. Technically speaking, it may not be the first yeshiva katana. It's like my calling the Baltanya. You heard the lecture, I call him the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I'm being criticized. I can't believe how people can be so juvenile. You follow me? What, I'm going to go into details in front of that audience, forgetting about the Baron Cutler, forgetting about the Rebbe, and start explaining how they got to Lubavitch and the Reb Shalom and the second Rebbe, and say that's if you give a lecture on Chabad. So let me put it this way. It's the first yeshiva katana organized by East European Jews, and there I believe I'm absolutely correct. And it's the first yeshiva katana that has continuity until this very moment in the year 2014. There is continuity. Okay? Now, what do we mean by yeshiva katana? Again, there are no great records. Who did the research? So here you'll see a lot of what I have to say today and next week is based upon a teacher of mine, Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Clapperman. If you haven't heard the name Gilbert Clapham, to make believe you did so, the ignorant pairs for the wise. Ellie certainly heard the name because he comes from the Five Towns, Rabbi Klapperman was the rabbi of Bet Shalom in Lawrence. He put that synagogue on the map. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. Rabbi Klapperman is in his 90s today, should live and be well. His first wife, who died young, was a fabulous Jewish historian. She wrote textbooks that we used in every Talmud Torah, the history of the Jews. I don't know if I'm giving the exact title, but that was Libby Klapperman. That was Gilbert's first wife. I then married a very well-known woman, an assemblywoman, Susan Alter, if my memory is correct. Thank you, Alan. Okay, so Rabbi Klapperman did a doctorate at Bernard Revel. His doctorate is on the early years of what today is Yeshiva University. He dealt with 1886 to 1915. It's called The Story of Yeshiva University. A guy named Rothkopf later came along and stood on the shoulders of Rabbi Klapperman and did a doctorate on Bernard Rebbe, which essentially covers 1915 to 1940. For whatever the reasons are, the historians at Yeshiva University decided that the history of Yeshiva ended with Rothkopf's work, and no one has stood on the shoulders of Rothkopf. Knowing Aaron Rothkopf quite well, the theory probably is he's a weakling, he's not a strong guy, he's a nice guy, he never fought with anyone, sometimes in class he'll sound very strong, and then a minute later he's a little teddy bear. So they're worried that his shoulders will cave in if anyone stands on them. I want to tell you that Rothkopf, when it comes to scholarship, has strong soldiers, and he told me to invite anyone to stand on them and go further. The time has come. It's 100 years since Rabbi Revel came to Yeshiva. We can go further, Kanayin Hara. Now, what we understand, and I'll tell you what Klapperman says, Gil, he was my teacher in college, by the way, Jewish sociology. I learned a lot from him. Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, basically, they learned Limudei Kodesh all day, 9 to 4. Now, that right away tells you a kid beginning at 9 o'clock has a clear mind. He's going to be motivated. He already can learn Shas properly. He can delve into Gemara. He can open up a Rambam. This kid can really learn 9 to 4. 4 to 6?
Was there yet in New York?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll tell you about that. The elementary school had to be, I'll deal with that in 1 second. From 4 to 6, they did their general studies, English, arithmetic, whatever the city required. Now, because the kids were older, if you're dealing already with 7th and 8th grade and early high school years, the city was very happy because it was the lower grades that were under supervision. But by the time a kid finished elementary school, in those years, a kid could go to work. See, it's not like today where even Satmar has to have high school. Even Lakewood branches have to have high schools. I was in Stanford, so they gave me a tour. I have a Talmud. A Talmud from this Kollel, married to a Talmidah from Machon Gold. I mean, you know, I talk a Talmud. Very lovely, lovely people there. They're probably grandparents today. They were my students many decades ago. She was in the 70s, and he was in the very early years of the Kollel. So this yeshiva, branch of Lakewood, a famous branch, Shustel, Rabbi Shustel, founded, he just died recently. His son is one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Lakewood. He's intermarried with the Cutler family, and he's one of the triumphant. I think there are three Rosh Yeshiva there. Four Rosh Yeshiva. One of them, his first cousin, is sitting down the hall right now, Rabbi Michael Olshin's first cousin, Rabbi Yerucham Olshin. And I tell you, don't be so impressed, Yisrael. He signed the baseball in Chicago. There's a Rakefer who signed the baseball, and Olshin signed the baseball. So whatever an Oisvaf Rakefer is, he signed the baseball too. Don't forget it. Anyway, I was their guest. Why? They gave me covered malachim in Stanford. Why? Because the yeshiva was closed down by the Board of Health, their kitchen. my student, a graduate of the Kollel, a musmach of yeshiva, is a top lawyer in the community. He went to bat, he straightened out the kitchen, got hold of the politicians, and they got back their charter, they could reopen, so they're very in debt to my Talmud. So he said, I want you to show me, oh, they show me around, show me, and then they show me, the English subjects are all a farce. The kids just have to get through, they give them the exams beforehand, they give them the regents before, whatever they do, I don't know. But it's all a farce. But still, they have to have a high school, you understand? Now, going back to 1886, you didn't need a high school. Now, there's another factor as well, another factor. These are kids coming in from Europe. You come in Chicago, one of the important tasks that I carried out. I just spoke with Chicago this morning, and I was very moved, very impressed. The Federation is organizing a new division to deal with descendants of Russian emigres. And they kicked it off with, by invitation only, an evening where I would speak and attempt to inspire them, which my wife says I did. And if my wife said I did, you can believe her, because she is a critic. So Malk and I were overwhelmed. But overwhelmed by what? These were people in their 40s, among them multimillionaires, many Balei Tshuva. They all came to America when they were 11, 12. And they're establishing a fund now of any kid of Russian origins who wants to go to day school, this fund will pay the tuition. So, but look what's happening here. You come to America. How many of you emigrated at the age of 10 or 11 or 12? You got to catch up, you know? You're a little bit ashamed. Min red yiddishn shtup. And yet, skate men afm gas? You have to speak English, not English. It's not today Borough Park. It's not today we speak, what do they call it? The Yiddish and English mixed together. What's the word they use for that? Yinglish, I think. Yinglish. Today, this is not Borough Park. I met Chassidim in Borough Park, particularly Sakma, who speak English with an accent. I couldn't believe it. I said, where were you born? I was born in Williamsburg. I was born in Monroe. I was born in New Square. With an accent. Ribbono shel Olam, you're an American. You're a Yankee. But today, unfortunately or fortunately, depending upon your hashkafa, it's no shame, ot kalon. Boy, I'm thinking in Hebrew, not in English. I'm really living here too long. Is ze lo ot kalon hayom, that I speak English with an accent, for ze hab geredt Yiddish, and they speak an Ungarische Yiddish, God have mercy, Galiziane Yiddish. Yes.
That they speak with an accent. I work in the community.
I know. Well, your yarmulke betrays you. That's a Satma yarmulke.
Most of them know it isn't. The Satmar has a rim around it. Mine is rimless.
So who wears a rimless? That's Bavav? What are you wearing? You're a renegade? And it's not a Ger yarmulke. That much. And Ger yarmulke is a little bit up. It pops up.
Yeah. You know, the difference is I don't have a rim. They have rims. But they barely, it's not just the accent. They barely speak. I have to make one correction. When you said the Satmar have a high school, they learn a little bit of English and a little bit of math. We're talking about in high school, they're learning math you would learn in early stages
of elementary school.
English. I mean, but if you said they have a secular second grade in high school, that
no, but my little story with Stamford, Connecticut tells you they bribe the inspectors, they have political power, they get by. But they have to have some sort of facade of a high school.
I don't think they have even a facade.
It's New York City. I can't believe that the politicians are totally bright.
I know what goes on there.
Okay, we'll accept your emendation. But it doesn't contradict what we're trying to say, that this in 1886, the city really didn't require high school yet. Now, but more than that, you had kids who came from Europe. These kids already had learned Gemara in Europe. They were older. But they were going to Eitz Chaim too. You had 7th and 8th grade, you had kids of high school age, you had kids, it's like a kid switches into yeshiva. So many of the day schools today, thank God, with the Baal Tshuva movement. And you know, again, we are sitting here, it's amazing how powerful the Baal Tshuva movement is. I've often stated that I believe that some of the best students I ever had, men or women, were the products of NCSY. And that goes for the Kollel, it goes for the women's colleges I taught in, it goes for BMT. It's an amazing world. But you have, what does a yeshiva have? A kid comes in 7th grade. So could you imagine a kid comes in, a 98 average in general subjects, comes in 7th grade, and when it comes to Limudei Kodesh, he's on a second grade level. Here you have the opposite. Kids are wandering around in Valgetzif, they're wandering around on the streets of New York. And these are kids who know how to learn Gemara and yet are ready for second, third grade in general subjects. So this is how Eitz Chaim began. Now, I want to thank Ephraim. He mentioned the source to me. Dafka, I know the whole background here, but I want to deal with his source, and then I want to take you into the school. And let me introduce a name to you. Professor Alexander Dushkin, Dushkin. Now, Professor, his years, 1890-1976. He is a very, very interesting individual, born in Suwalk, Poland, White Russia. It changed hands many times. Why is Suwalk? What do you recognize right away? Why did Suwalk arrive? Reb David Lifshitz, the last rabbi of Suwalk, came to America in 1941, taught in Chicago Hebrew Theological College, what you call Skokie today. And in 1944, I believe it was 43, 44, you have to, I write about it, I think, in the Rav, if maybe in Washington I mention it. I think I mentioned it in Washington too. Reb David came to Yeshiva University. So this was Suwalk, and he came to America, exactly what we're talking about, 11, the age of 11, a very bright kid, goes on to get a doctorate in education. Now, he was one of what they used to call the Benderly boys, the Samson Benderly. The name mean anything to you? No. Okay, Samson Benderly. There was an attempt, again, I'm covering topics that you could spend hours on, but it's not germane to what I want to do, the history of Torah in the United States. In the World War I period, before and after, there was an attempt to organize a kehillah in New York City. Are you aware of that? A doctorate was done by Professor Gorin at Hebrew University on the kehillah experiment. It was a real attempt to do what they did with Rabbi Jacob Joseph, but on a much broader level with support of all elements of the community. Now, right away, you have a problem. New York, what do? Religious Jews can sit with irreligious Jews. You're going to deal with chinuch, you're going to deal with Shabbat, you're going to deal with kashrut. Lo daki dakechem, lo machshavotai machshavoteichem. How do you bridge? How do you bridge the two? Gentlemen, there are two seats here. Kol hakavod that you came from Rehovot and the weather did not scare you. Okay. We're rolling. Ah, oh, you're missing. And yesterday, the Chazon Ish, we're rolling. Believe me, don't talk too loud about my classes, because Richie Joel will say, Rakefet, you have so much kana giving these classes. Forget it. You owe us $200 a month nachas tax. Okay? Instead of our paying you, you pay us. And he can do it yet. Believe me, with Yeshiva's current financial state. Hakol yitachen. So, you see, they try to organize tequila. Now, by the way, they were well aware of the fact that the East European Jews are not going to sit with the German Reformed Jews. So, to give you an example, by the way, they tried to organize kashrut. They really were serious and well-meaning. When it came to chinuch, they had two separate bodies, general chinuch and Orthodox chinuch. Now, the general chinuch was headed up by Samson Bendeley. A person named Nat Winter, Zichrono Livracha, did his doctorate on Samson Bendeley. Nathan Winter was also in chinuch. He was like a grandson of Bendeley. Bendeley's boys, Dushkin was a direct disciple, and Nat Winter was a disciple of a disciple. Anyone recognize the name Nat Winter? He was my congregant in Maplewood. He and his family has a brother who's a YU Musmach from my area, my era, who worked for the Mizrahi in New York, Rabbi Winter. That is a younger brother of Nathan Winter, Yibodo L'chaim Aruchim V'tovim. Now, Dushkin was Bendeley's right hand. And Dushkin went on to a very fascinating career, headed up Jewish education in Chicago, the Board of Jewish Education, winds up in Israel, was principal of some of the top high schools in Jerusalem, goes on to become professor of Jewish education at the Hebrew University, and spends most of his adult life right here in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh. His doctorate and his most famous book is Jewish Education in New York City. And Ephraim told me that it's available on the website. And I'm just overwhelmed. This is a rare book that I looked at last when I was studying in Bernard Rebel Graduate School. And here, you go to the website, you can pull the book out. It's beyond words what we have today, what the treasure we have. I want to tell you that I'm holding an asifa the week after the election, a major demonstration. I am declaring war on cars. Since cars were invented, over 32 million people have been killed. We cannot have cars, no driving of cars. Cars cannot be seen. We are doing away with cars. I learned from Agudat Yisrael, you have to hold an asifa and get rid of the websites. We'll get rid of the cars. Gentlemen, you got the message. Anyway, on page 73, he begins a description of how Jewish education in New York City, Alexander Dushkin, Jewish education in New York City, PhD thesis, excuse me, I said Hebrew University before? No, that was in the Kehila. This was a PhD thesis at Columbia University. Gorin's thesis, I said Gorin Hebrew? Okay, so Gorin, I was right. But Dushkin's thesis, I wonder where his grandchildren are today. I wonder what world they're in Israel. PhD thesis, Columbia University, 1918, Jewish education in New York City. And on page 73, he begins his description of Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. And there's one, he describes how it began. They rented a room, 47 East Broadway. Watch. And he's interviewed people. But our financial condition was so poor that we had no money with which to buy books. So we bought one Gemara for 90 cents and tore it into three parts, giving one part to each of the three Melamdim. So I don't have to tell you, a description like that brings tears to your eyes. Imagine how poor they were. But that they were poor goes without saying. That they bought one Gemara and ripped it in three. There are two reasons. I think it's anecdotal, not factual. One reason I'll get to later this morning. But the first reason is very simple. Mahu ilim chachama b'takantan. If three Rebbeim have to teach Gemara, they're teaching the same Gemara. You rip the Gemara in three, you have three different sugyas. What are they teaching? The kids have to learn. The whole idea of a yeshiva is everyone learns the same Gemara. I mean, for instance, you take the Kolel. I think we learn what they're learning in the Gush, if I'm not mistaken. That's the cycle they follow here. In YU, when they pick the Rebbe used to pick a Gemara, The whole yeshiva went with the Gemara. I remember the year, the Rav Pik Sanhedrin, you can't even start to understand this, the Rav Pik Sanhedrin, so Mistabrums, I already was a big shot, I was in the middle of college, and I was in the Rav, I was one of the ones, that, again, Washington, that fought that the Rav should give a shiur to us college gangsters. And so Mr. Abrams tells me that I let the one of the rebellion is going crazy that he has to say Sheyurim in Sanhedrin. So I asked Mr. Abrams why. Because in Telj there were never Sheyurim in Sanhedrin. And he was all upset that suddenly they're choosing a Masechet that was not a Yeshivish Masechet. Yeshivish Masechet are Nashim and Ezekiel. You all know that. And the Rav chose Sanhedrin. Now, and the whole yeshiva had to switch to Sanhedrin. And this Rebbe was furious. I don't know, let's rest in peace. I don't want to mention his name. But he was not a Rebbe of mine. But I remember Mr. Abrams telling me, Rabbi Dash is so upset. You have no idea, Arnold. He never heard Shayurim. How will he be able to teach? All right. That was a certain mentality. The Rav's mentality I recorded in Washington was just the opposite. Arnold, teach what you don't know. If you teach what you don't know, you learn, and the students also learn. And believe me, all my life I've been teaching what I don't know. I apologize, but I was an ignorant youngster. Okay, so I don't believe they could rip the Gemara in three. Each Rebbe would have a different sugya. But nevertheless, it shows you the poverty. To start our yeshiva, and he's interviewing some, he's quoting him word by word. The directors went about the neighborhood collecting nickels and dimes which were given to us. In order to maintain the yeshiva, the directors had to post up boxes in private homes and in synagogues, and then go personally to collect the money which good people deposited in them for our yeshiva. Now, you see, this is the tzedakah box. It's something, I don't know if you have it today, but when I grew up, you always had a tzedakah box in the house. And essentially, the tzedakah box was for Eretz Yisrael, you understand. And the nickels and dimes, this is the description that inspires me and haunts me and comes to life when I see it. But you fellas can't even understand it. But Salanta Yeshiva, where I went, was always impoverished. During the winter, there was always a problem, not enough money for heat. There was always a tragedy waiting around the corner. And Thursday night, Rabbi Savitz, who came from Boston, by the way. I don't know, Yitzchak, if you recognize his father was Clay Kodesh in Boston. Am I right or wrong? Do you remember what his father did? He was Rav of a shul. He was what, a sheikhet? What was he exactly? But you remember Rabbi Savitz. So his son was the executive director of Solanta. So he would hire a sound truck. We would go to the heart of the Bronx. And you have to understand, the Bronx at that time was 60. There were neighborhoods 80% Jewish, 90% Jewish. And Thursday night, everyone would be rushing home, get ready for Shabbos. Not that everyone was a Shomer Shabbos. A Shomer Shabbos was 1 out of 100, 1 out of 500. But people at least knew what Shabbos was. It's given you to pay a shemenshin. Many were survivors. And the sound truck would stand where you'd come down on four sides from the Yell, from the subway in the air, which you don't even today, the third of the Yell is gone, but this was further over, Soundview. Could be it still exists, I don't know. And on the sound truck, they would be making an appeal, and there would be, at each exit where you came out, yeshiva boys would be holding the Zionist flag. It's before there's a state of Israel. And they'd be making, he'd be on the sound truck making an impassioned appeal. The doors of the yeshiva should be kept open. These children who are our future need heat, need warmth, need food, health, and everything in Yiddish. And people went by and dropped in dimes and quarters and dimes and quarters. And that's the way Solanta kept open. So here you see, this is the way they raise funds. It's not like today when Kanayin Hara, we have Talmidim of mine who can get up and pledge $1 million without batting an eyelash. You understand? I have friends on the Yeshiva Board of Trustees, and he tells me, we were sitting in King David, I was their guest, and he showed shows me this fellow over there just gave $10 million to YU, and he's shaking. I say, you're shaking. You just gave $1 million. I'm shaking, you understand? But can I hurry up? These are Jews. It's different times. But his description here is beautiful. And he goes into details of the curriculum, essentially what I told you. And then he tells us that in 1901, 15 years later, another elementary yeshiva was founded. And of course, this yeshiva was founded under a name that none of you ever heard of, myself included, Beth Sefer Tiferet Jerusalem, Tiferet Yerushalayim. And what is that? Tiferet Yerushalayim, people, Jerusalem, what Yerushalayim means to a Jew. By the way, not to some of our political leaders here, Barak, I can tell you stories, what went on, Rabin, Kanayim, but to a real Jew, what Yerushalayim means. You shake when you mention the name. When Rav Kook mentioned Yerushalayim, he broke down in tears in Chutz Laaretz. We have eyewitness accounts when you Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, and 1 year later, they changed the name. Can anyone tell me what they changed it to? 1901. What happened in 1902? Rabbi Yaakov Yosef died. Tiferet Yerushalayim became RJJ. And RJJ, continuity until today. But there was a big difference between Eitz Chaim and RJJ. And that difference we just alluded to. Eitz Chaim was basically older children, 7th and 8th grade. Whether they had a 5th or a 6th grade, we'll never know for sure. Klapman discusses it. High school age kids who were already Messiah 4, 5 Mesechtot in Europe, Europeisha kids. But now they have to improve their English. They should be able to talk like a good American, not like a greenhorn. So they were in Eitz Chaim. RJJ already began 1st grade to 8th grade, government supervision, a more expanded general studies program, and that was RJJ. And as you know, the story of RJJ, some of you, anyone here go to RJJ? Your parents, grandparents, it's called the Mama of Allah Americana Yeshivat. The mother, I don't know why the mother should be called the father, but somehow we love mothers more than fathers, and that's natural. There are reasons why, absolutely. The Rev gave a whole talk on that in 1968 in memory of Rebbetzin Tanya. Part of that talk appears in Family Redeemed, and part of the talk also appears, what Family Redeemed does not have, in the Rav by my good friend Aaron Rothkopf. And you'll ask why Rothkopf has material that Family Redeemed doesn't have, and he'll give you the answer that Rakefet wrote in Washington to Washington. You will see the answer. Alan, we are promoting certain publications, no two ways about it. And halavai, later this year I should be zeicha to promote Bernard Revel and the Silver Era. You should know, Yitzchak, I got a call from Chicago that my work on the Silver Era was praised to the sky this Shabbos by the president of Agudat Yisrael in America. And it's not the first time I've gotten feedbacks of this nature. So Baruch Hashem, and even Yitzchak has not said a bad word about Agudat Yisrael, even though I mentioned it now. Kol hakavod. Now, gentlemen.
You know, when people listen to this, they may end up thinking that I'm really some sort of a...
Nothing. Yitzchak. Whenever I go to Borough Park, I am accosted by my many students there via the website. Who is that Rabbi Reuben? Is he Orthodox? And I tell them 100%, but he's a little bit left of center. You're entitled. Baruch Hashem, there's freedom of opinion and freedom of choice. And I always tell them, you should know this, that we can argue from today to tomorrow, but when I tell Rabbi Rubin what the Rav said, this is the Rav, the argument ends. So Baruch Hashem, we're entitled to differ. This is not Chassidut or Das Torah. I want to introduce you to a fabulous volume that we already quoted. The Education of Abraham Kahn, C-A-H-A-N, published by JPS, 1969. Beginning on page 371, he begins a description of Eitz Chaim that is absolutely precious. And historically, totally correct. And because he had no axe to grind, it's a tremendous source for what went on in Eitz Chaim. Now, Josh and Josh, I see you sitting at both ends of the classroom. Who was Abe Kahn? Do you remember where I quoted him? In relation to RJJ? In relation to Vilna? Abe Kahn came from a very pious home, and he already in Europe left religion, didn't just leave religion, became an anarchist, a raving socialist. Today, by 1917, you would have called him a communist. And his friends were arrested and hanged in public. So you could imagine, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm being factual, being literal. He emigrated to the United States. In America, very brilliant mind. He still soon mastered English, although his writing language was Yiddish. It's very interesting. Those of you that are in psychology, perhaps you can explain it. But most people can speak many languages. I speak three languages. But you only write well in one language. It's interesting. It's very rare that someone should have the ability, let's say Shalom Aleichem, who they say could write equally well in Yiddish and in Hebrew. It's very rare. Most people write in one language. I know that in Yiddish I wouldn't even attempt to write. Hebrew I write daily. I write Hebrew fine, but not on the level of English. English I write already. I know how to use the thesaurus and dictionary. Baruch Hashem, English is my native writing language. Even though speaking, I'm totally at home in Hebrew. I speak Hebrew, I think, better than English. But it's not the language I will write in. Whatever scholarship I've published in Hebrew, Rakafarar and Chelik Bet, the third of it is in Hebrew, my daughters styled it. They had to edit it. I certainly don't give my daughters my English work to edit. So he wrote a fabulous autobiography, Blätter von mein Leben, pages out of my life, Blätter von mein Leben. When they translated into English, they didn't translate it leaves out of my life. They translated the Education of Abraham Kahn. He wrote a multi-volume memoir, autobiography, and the English translation is a condensation of a number of volumes into one very readable volume. Now, believe it or not, when Eitz Chaim began, he was the first or one of the first general studies teachers. We kommt an anarchist, a socialist, a communist, a Bundist. Where does he come to Eitz Chaim? No, he was a struggling immigrant. He's not yet the famous Abe Kahn. By the way, he goes on to be the editor of the Forwards. That's the famous Forwards, which is trying to put Yeshiva University under at this moment in time, is a direct result or a direct descendant of what Abe Kahn was editor of, the forwards. Today, what is it in English? It's not in Yiddish. But the four, when I was growing up, the Forwards, the Wahrheit, they were the leftist papers. The Morgan Journal and the Tug were more religious and Zionist. Yeah, and later on, the Morgan Journal was the survivor because it catered to religious Jews, so there was a religious readership. which today already Satmar has its own paper, so no one's going to, the Mugger Journal 2, I believe, is basically almost all in English or partially in English today. Whatever exists today, it's more Chabad, I understand. All right. But the forwards, wow. Why does he come to yeshiva? He needed a few bucks. But you'll see from this description that, you see, he was an earnest, sincere individual. Who taught in high school? When I went to Talmudical Academy for me was the best experience ever in my life as far as learning and teachers. And all my friends say the same thing. I don't know what happened. When I taught, I know today I meet endless students who tell me they maledicted every Rebbe in high school. They were animals. They were sadists. I don't want to go any further. I don't want to spell out what's on my mind because they'll call me to testify yet in the lawsuit. But Rebbe, you're the only one that no one maledicted. No one, Baruch Hashem, even no kid had a bad word to say. When I went to high school, I had fabulous rabbis. The English teachers, the secular teachers, the general studies teachers, who were they? They came from public schools. Now, could you imagine from 9 to 3 they taught in a public school? Well, public school kids, gangsters, hooligans, who cares about education? The 1950s, give us dance and fun and, I don't know, not drugs yet, but a little liquor, whatever. Then they came to yeshiva. And they met such good kids, such sincere kids, such respectable kids. Our general studies teachers were lovely, were fabulous, were encouraging. They always went the extra mile because they saw their students who appreciated it. I can still remember what decent human beings they were. Ugh, he was an individual like that. And he describes Eitz Chaim, exactly what we spoke about, where it was located, and old-fashioned Orthodox Jews. This is Ave Khan talking, all right? In his eyes, and Ben-Gurion's eyes. Remember what Ben-Gurion said in 20 years? There won't be a Frum Jew left. They're old-fashioned. Wanted their children to be raised in America as they themselves had been raised in the old country. This meant that their children could not attend the public schools where Yiddish was not spoken, and skull caps were prohibited. Of course, a kid's going to learn Gemara? What language do you learn Gemara in? You can't learn Gemara in any other language but Yiddish. Right or wrong? You know my viewpoint. Okay. The day that the Rav stopped speaking Yiddish, Torah came to an end. Say Zayin Gerecht, we come and learn our sugya. Excuse me? Yitzchak, what, you don't have a sense of humor? What am I, off the wall? Of course I know what language we have to teach in. But, by the way, my grandchildren, I have to tell you, I'm always amazed how well they could learn Gemara with the Aramaic. It's something to do with, if you know Hebrew, Aramaic is not that hard. I don't know, for us to pick up Aramaic, I know how hard it was for me. I know I quote the Rav, in the Rav, where the Rav talks about, I quote him in Washington too, how hard it was, not just Gemara Lashon, not just Hebrew, Aramaic. And the kids here, wow, am I impressed by these kids, kala kavod. All right, they don't learn in Yiddish, they learn in Hebrew, Kanai and Hara. But here, Abe Kahn says it, they got to speak Yiddish, means for Gemara. Not, and then, how can you learn without a skull cap? Which comes to the question you asked the questions of Rabbi Bebnash and Rabbi Jeffrey Weider. Today I remember, Jeremy Weider. I got to learn that name because I just met him recently. I never knew him, but I knew of him. Rabbi Jeremy Weider, you asked the question, how do you feel about learning biology, chemistry? No, the truth is you have to learn with a skull cap. This is also knowing God, all right? It's not, I don't think you make a Birchat HaTorah, but Chochmah it is. And if you have knowledge, Marabu Masecha Hashem, wow, what we can do with knowledge. And imagine a Jew comes along who doesn't have a person. Remember, in Rakefet's opinion, the most important profession or calling in the world is to be a Rebbe. But if you can't be a Rebbe, if you can be a space scientist, and do great things, this too is a gift from God, right? We make a bracha on a Gadol B'Yisrael, and we make a bracha on a Nobel Prize winner. All right, the brachot are slightly different, but nevertheless, okay? So he explains why they needed this type of yeshiva. In yeshiva, they tzayim, young men could study Gemara in the old country manner. Yet despite the most pious wishes of the Orthodox, America was different than Poland and Lithuania. You had to have some general studies. Reluctantly, the yeshiva hired a few teachers to give the boys a smattering of secular subjects. Okay? And now, a fabulous description. I don't know if we'll get there today, but we'll get to our friend from Satmar and his book on RJJ, what he does to Eitz Chaim, how he misrepresents the facts. How do you talk to such an individual, Alan? I give you a charge. I want him here in class within the year. Produce Yonah Landau. And tell him the Rebbe loves him, but adopt sign a mensch. And being a mensch means emet, not sheker. Hashem Elokeichem emet. Sheker, we get nowhere. And if he doesn't believe it, the Satmar Rebbe said it. Look into Rav Kamenetsky's work, Making of a Gadol. Look at the Rav Nussan's quote from the Satmar Rebbe. And if he doesn't believe Rav Nussan, look into Rakefit's review of the book in Jewish Action, where the quote is also there. Okay. Now he describes the teachers. Watch. A 14-year-old lad who has just completed public school was assigned to the younger group, while I was assigned to the older boys. Now, you're sitting there, you're going out of your mind. Yes, in 1886, that a 14-year-old kid had completed public school, this was an achievement. In Israel today, if a Beis Yaakov girl completes Beis Yaakov High School, she's ready to teach. It's a big achievement. All right, now a world without the, today, at one time, without a college degree. Today, without a postgraduate degree. But you got to view it in the terminology of 1886. So a 14-year-old kid is teaching the younger kids, and I was assigned to the older boys, Abe Kahn says, and I taught the older kids. For 2 hours each day, we transformed the yeshiva into classrooms. No one could tell us what to teach. The gabayim, the people who ran the yeshiva, what did they know? They never went to public school. But my curriculum included grammar, second level arithmetic, reading and spelling. This made it look like a school. The Gabayim didn't know what was flying, couldn't care less. Their whole attitude was negative. I told you, when we come to it, we actually have quotes. Gil Klapman actually brings quotes where Gabayim would say, it's good enough for us, a bit of language, we know a little language, we made money in America, what do you have to know anymore? That was their attitude. But they realized the kids need something, the kids want something. It's America. You don't want to be a greenhorn. It's not Israel. Israel's the only country in the world where you can live here for 50 years and not speak a sentence of Hebrew. And I know people like that. All right, not kids. Kids come here educated. But you come older. People can be in high tech. People can be in the medical profession. There's no end to what you can do. Who needs English? Until today, I open my mouth in Hebrew. They answer me in English. But I have a principle. I will not speak English to an Israeli. They can answer me in English, I continue in Hebrew. Let them break their teeth in English, and I want to speak Hebrew. I enjoy speaking Hebrew. Okay? But this is a different country. This is an ingathering of exiles that was meant to be an ingathering of exiles that functions on a different level altogether. It's not America. There's no melting pot here in that sense, just the opposite. If you come in from America, Canada, Great Britain, South Africa, Australia, you think you're a big shot. No, I speak English. I have mentality. Modern mentality. I have a doctorate. Who are you? I had education. Who are you? You built a country, built an army. You know what it means to build an army? You have any idea what an army is? Any idea how an army functions? What's involved? And with Jews to build an army? How many times have I told people this? To take orders, a chain of command? You see what's going on now? The report that came out yesterday? Here, the whole state of Israel stands or falls on its politicians and its armies, and they acted as if they're shul president fighting with the vice president in shul. Right or wrong? That's the whole report. It's beyond words. Ashkenazi, Barak, the head of the sisterhood, Ashkenazi's wife, we have a miracle here. People ask you, why you celebrate Yom HaTzmut? You don't have to give them any pupil. Don't even quote Rav Kefet. Don't go into any of his lectures. Don't quote the... Just tell them plain and simple that the army remains a decent army despite the fact that it's a Jewish army. Nes gadol hayapo. Look at today's newspapers. All right. Teaching. Ah, and then he describes what went on with money. Members of the society who supported the yeshiva were in the main custom peddlers, or just plain peddlers. You know what the difference is. People had pushcarts. That's a plain peddler. A custom peddler, he knocked on the door. Was kann ich euch bringen? What can I bring you next week? Oh, I don't know what they had then. I still remember in my youth they would sell vacuum cleaners. Oh, that was a custom peddler. He showed you a catalog. You picked out, oh, it's like the internet today. No different. The internet is a custom peddler. Exactly. Right or wrong? They showed a cartoon of a man and a woman in their, pardon me, their undergarments in a store buying. And they look at them. How come you're in your, the internet broke down. We couldn't order. They had no clothes. All they could come was with undergarments. And then that's a custom peddler. And these poor people donated nickels and dimes to support the yeshiva. Now, he describes, I was deeply touched by the plight of these children. For this reason, I spent more time at the yeshiva than my agreement called for. I could feel the warmth and appreciation in their responses. My own devotion to my pupils grew stronger. Most of them were able youngsters. They went for my instruction in the same way a thirsty man rushes to a spring of fresh water. And I want to tell you, this paragraph should be a classic description that every future mechanech teacher Rebbe should be taught. And this is the secret of education, the joy of education. It's like seeing a child grow up. You ever see a child, you get all excited, the kid turns over. My grandchildren called to tell me, my great-granddaughter just turned over. Ah! A few weeks later, she's standing up. Friday, I already got a report. She's walking, holding on to the edge of a couch. You see a kid grow. Kid starts to speak. It's the greatest joy in life. Marabu Masecha Hashem. Same thing with a student. No different. When Chazal referred to Bonim as Bonim, your students are children. Ein Rav Mekaneh Bivno, Ein Av Mekaneh Bivno, the Ein Rav Mekaneh Bitalmido. This is the greatest joy. This is a great teacher. He didn't punch a clock. You should know, according to my contract with Yeshiva University, I'm supposed to be in this building 3 hours a week. An hour and a half on Sunday and an hour and a half on Monday. I'm willing to bet you I'm in this building longer than most kids in Torah Shraga. V'day l'chakima. V'day l'chakima. And I love this description. They went for my instruction in the same way a thirsty man rushes to a spring of fresh water. The Orthodox Gabbayim would advise me not to waste my energy on these lessons. They know enough English as it is, one said to me on several times. He was naive, but honest. I could not be angry at him. The job provided me with a few dollars and a lot of pleasure. Listen to this. The boys were earnest in their work. I taught them as if I were my own, as if they were my own children. It's very impressive. Abe Kahn, we differed theologically, religiously, maybe up in heaven you see the error of your ways, but as a Rebbe, I have to tell you, I appreciate your insights and your understanding of what chinuch is about. But here we come to the high point. And here I'll tell you why I don't want to accept a Gemara ripped in three as factual, but as allegorical. And by the way, an allegory is also important. We once discussed with the Rav after class. I don't know how we had the guts, but we asked Rebbe about all these stories about Gedolei Yisrael. There's a vulgar in sich, you know. They appear, this one, that one, the same story. Did it really happen? And I'll never forget, the Rav said, it's not important whether it really happened, but it shows you the image Gedolei Yisrael had in the eyes of the Hamon Ha'am, of the masses. And that's why an allegory may not be totally true, but it reveals the period. They had a Rippa Gemara in three. The Ritbaz is locked in an icebox in a slaughterhouse. The mafia hopes he'll asphyxiate and they'll be done with him. Did it happen? Got on the train Shabbos morning, ran to New York. I don't know if it happened. I seem to think it did, but no one knows. No one could tell me. We have no written record. We can't find his train ticket. But the allegory is revealing. Now, what do you need to teach? What do you need? One of the big problems in Israel, textbooks. In Israel today, they don't allow you to invalidate textbooks automatically. It used to be every year a new edition appeared. Yeah. Today, unless it's a scientific field where there really are rapid changes, they use the same textbook in elementary school, in high school. They pass it on, you buy it secondhand. People complain. Textbooks can cost a fortune. By the way, the Chazon Ish book I referred to yesterday is on to 950 pages. Well, I said in class yesterday, I think I said 800, 900. I looked last night when I was working with the book. 900, on to 950 pages, a single volume. And boy, do I regret they didn't divide it in half. I would have gladly paid twice the price for the Don bindings, but a 900-page book is unwieldy to hold in your hands and to use. And, you know, the older you get, weight is weight. Wow. No, you need textbooks. Textbooks. The last thing in the world that the Gabayim are going to spend money on. Textbooks? You have a blackboard. You can teach them. What is this, a Chumash, a Gemara? They have to save it, a textbook. Real problem. I nagged the Gabayim so persistently that in the end, I succeeded in some measure, at least, in getting money assigned for books. Now watch who bought the books. Look who shows up again. My dearest family. They almost destroyed the joy of life for me. This happened after Joshua Rothstein, a cap manufacturer, was elected. You read my mind already. He was elected the new president of the yeshiva. I explained to him how essential it was to get English language books, readers, arithmetic texts, histories, being more broad-minded than the other Gabayim. And no fool, he said, quote, "You're right, Mr. Khan. We should all thank you for your kindness and devotion to the boys." He promised to get the money, and he did. My dear friends, is anyone here from Torah Shraka? No one here. Does anyone know a kid in Torah Shraka? Shmuley Gordis. Any of the Kolo boys? Do me a favor. Tell Shmuley Gordis what the connection is, because Shmuley Gordas and Aaron Rakefet share a love of baseball. Shmuley Gordas' family are part owners of the Marlin Angels. The Florida Marlins. Give me the right name I'm looking for. Florida Marlins. Okay? He has met with some of the Gedolim Shebaretz on the ball field. They take pictures of him, a cousin of the owners. You dance to the tune of the guys that are paying you $15 million a year for smacking a few balls. Today, if you're 250 already, you're a king. Rakefet in his prime hit a lot more than 250. God. Joshua Rothstein? No, who is he? This is the grandfather of Arnold Rothstein. We spoke about him. Joshua, the father of Abraham. Abraham, the father of Arnold Rothstein. Joshua and Abraham, tremendous from Jews. Big supporters of Yeshiva University, what is today, gave a fortune. You're not allowed to sit in these seats. The money, Arnold Rothstein, every Motzai Shabbos gave his father money to give to Tzedakah. You're sitting on seats built by the Rothstein family. Arnold Rothstein, world famous for being the mastermind behind the Black Sox scandal of 1919, which practically destroyed baseball. Could you imagine a world without baseball? I don't want to imagine it. Danny, will you please convey to Mr. Shmuley Goldis, who promised me he would come to class today, to hear why he can't sit on the seats in this room at this moment of time, and Mr. Joshua Rothstein, who was a successful cap manufacturer. I just bought a new cap. If you come to the Cult of Friday night, you'll see my black cap, because my cousin Bobby Ash, the big psychologist, gave us problems. The rabbi doesn't wear a black hat. I bought a beautiful black cap. I never got 35 shekels with ear, beautiful. What a buy. First is in the heart of Yerushalayim. Okay. He was a cap manufacturer. He gave the money to buy the textbooks. Now, if Joshua Rothstein gave money in 1887, 1888 to buy English, secular, general textbooks, Alach HaKama V'Kama, they would have gotten out of Mr. Rothstein, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, money to buy Shas and Paiskim. So that's why I can't accept Dushkin's story at face value, but it makes for fascinating reading. And Rakefet's question, how do we solve it? Three different Rebbeim with three different sections, three different prukkim. How do you teach the same text to the different students? Okay, fabulous material. I just want to go one step further for a very personal reason. I'm quoting page 347. When I was growing up, 1947, that was a year, you know, I became a real kid, grew up. I was turned 10 years old that year at the end of the year. That was also, for talking about baseball, that was the year there'll never be a World Series like the 47 series, the Dodgers and the Yankees. Wow. I can spend hours describing what went on that year. But remember I told you, there are not many people alive. I take a schut. I spoke in learning with Rabbi Yosef Elio Henkin, with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, with Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. I also mentioned I yet knew Jews in the Bronx who yet knew personally and spoke to Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Check your almanacs, check the computer. The last day of 1947, New York had one of its worst blizzards ever. And schools were shut down for 2-3 days. It was unbelievable. You couldn't budge. New Year's Day. Buses stopped. Trains stopped. I don't recall, perhaps 25 inches of snow. So the old timers in shul all said to me, "Junger Mann, young man, du denkst, das ist etwas, you think that this blizzard is something? Mir dem Mann in sich was ist gewesen, mit mehr wie Kies, 50 Jahre zurück. We remember what was more than 50 years ago, 60 years ago." And they started talking about the blizzard of 88. That they never saw a snow like it in their lives. I want to tell you, beginning on page 374, he talks about the blizzard of 88. Why? When I think of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, I am reminded of the great blizzard that raged in and around New York from March 11th to March 14th, 1888. The city was attacked by wild winds and snow and hail and a severe frost. It was the worst snowstorm ever experienced in New York. It became almost impossible to walk in the streets. Horses stumbled and streetcars were unable to run. And why does he talk about it? Because he had gone to teach. A good teacher doesn't look at the weather. You hope for the best. Hope for the best. My wife called me this morning. How did you get there? She's worried. So I said, I had a miracle when I finished davening, went to my car, drove here. There was not a drop of rain. Who's giving us a bang and trying to contradict me, but let it be, I testify again, not a drop of rain. Ah, when he finished teaching, he practically could not walk home. I felt the full force of the blizzard as I strove to make my way home from the yeshiva. We lived then on Elder Street between Broome and Delancey. I had reached Grand Street and had begun to cross it when suddenly felt as if I were being lashed on my face and body with a dozen cruel whips. I felt weak, helpless, desperate. For a moment, it seemed I was going to sink into the ground. I would have cried out for help, but it would have been useless. The wind roared louder than I could shout. And the few figures I could dimly perceive through the churning turbulence seemed also to be engaged in desperate struggles to save themselves. I turned my head from the wind and, having caught my breath, was able to continue. I have to tell you, this English translation is second to none. It reads like world-class literature. And for those of you that are going to do a movie on the early years of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, don't forget to have the Israeli movie industry rent out some space in Hollywood and do a scene of Abraham Kahn teaching as the blizzard begins and struggling home with the message dedication. Let me end off. The final chapter of his relationship with Eitz Chaim is not a happy one. And here you come to the very delicate question, who teaches our children? As you recall yesterday, and as I write and intimate, although I don't spell it out in Washington, and I try to be very positive in Washington, why should I be negative about anyone? Because the Ribbono Shel Olam has been very kind to me. Alan will testify, I came unwanted, uncalled, unsought. No one, anyone greet you when you arrived at the airport today? Nefesh b'nefesh, bands, prime ministers. We came, got off the boat. It was, the boat pulled in on Shabbos. We had to wait till after Shabbos to disembark, and it was the middle of the night. It was summer. Shabbos ended at 8:30, Haifa. And thank God, I found my place. There's no need to be negative. But it's a delicate question. Rakefet stated in class yesterday, in the middle of a heavyweight shiur in the Chazon Ish, and how we paskin and halacha kabatra'i, that his first Rebbe of Gemara was a Mechalel Shabbos. And it was not just me. In everyday school, half your teachers were Mechalalei Shabbos, teaching Limudei Kodesh. This is the 30s into the 40s. Rabbi Schmidman of Toras Chaim, of Bensonhurst, told me, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the Schmidman, the grandfather of all the famous Rabbi Schmidmans. He said, your mother-in-law was the greatest teacher I ever had. She taught third grade. Sure, she was a fabulous teacher. Could you imagine having a general studies teacher who was a Shomeret Shabbos born in the United States? Where did you find someone like that? The early 1930s. She taught Rav Shlomo Freidfeld, Rav Aaron Schechter, the Chaim Berlin Rosh Yeshiva, whole list of Gedolei Yisrael who were her students. Knew that I suffer by having Mechalel Shabbos for a teacher of Gemara? In my case, no. He was a fabulous teacher. But this is a very important question. I don't want to minimize it. Here you have Abe Kahn, who's now becoming very famous, a spokesman on the East Side. You got to read the memoir. It's kedai to read it. It'll introduce you to a whole different world. And you'll start to understand why they blame communism upon the Jews. Unfortunately, we are very bright people, and we're always looking for tikkun ha'olam, and every ism attracts us. Like today, in every type of good deed happening, so-called good deed, you'll find Jews leading the cause. Okay? And some of these causes are the antithesis of Torah and Torah civilization. Some. So Abe Kahn is now speaking at rallies on the East Side. Abe Kahn is now writing articles. This Sheikitz is teaching in the yeshiva. This Oisvaf is teaching our children general studies. This intellectual gangster is polluting the air. How dare you keep him in the yeshiva? And ultimately, his sojourn at Eitz Chaim was only 2 years, not more. And they got rid of him. They made him very uncomfortable. He couldn't come back. He had to walk away and go on to become Abe Kahn, the editor of the forewords. His extremism was tempered by the years, and he was a socialist, but no longer a radical socialist. But not anti-religious, I would say, but just a-religious. Religion has no place for the modern intelligent man. How did the communists put it? Religion, the opium of the masses. That quote, they claim, goes all the way back to Marx, who himself was the grandson of Gedolei Yisrael. But that's Abe Kahn, that's the yeshiva, that's Eitz Chaim, that's how it begins. Ah, what a story. Next week, 36 grand to get into the class, to the IOU list. What happens later? Shiva Shul Chanan. The merger. The dream. The idea. What happened to Akiva Matlin? We traced it down. But that's for next week. What did we do this week? Entire shiur devoted to the start of Eitz Chaim. And again, to be intellectually honest, it's not a full blossomed day school. You don't have that until RJJ, which is 15 years later, 1901, 1902, it's renamed basically. RJJ is RJJ. Very fascinating school. When Rabbanan came to America, RJJ became the main feeder school for Lakewood. When I learned in Lakewood, some of the top American Talmidim who go on to become Rosh Yeshiva all over the United States were RJJ products. But Eitz Chaim was Eitz Chaim, the first to do it. 2 hours a day general studies, older youngsters and younger elder students, let's put it that way. But it took hold, it caught on, it continues. Abe Kahn, we visited the school. We were there. We were in the classroom. My dear students, on Sunday, Be'ezrat HaNotein La'Yov Koach, We pick up with the Chazon Ish, Rav Tzvi Yehuda. I'm in a good mood, so on Sunday I am giving each one who comes to class 30,000 grand credit on the IOU list. A brief correction. I don't know how I made the mistake, because I didn't even know that I know this. In a lecture I gave in 1996, that, gentlemen, please, the website has everything. Kol Masecha B'Sefer Nichtavim. Open up Pirkei Avot, and you'll see Yisrael, you can't escape. You cannot be a subject of change. Pirkei Avot has it right. I get Rabbi Lezer Reich, my dear Talmud from Manchester, who's probably my age or older. So I mentioned in class that Dayan Feldman of the London United Synagogue was the father of Rav Feldman of Kitzur Shulchan Aruch fame. He corrects me. I don't know how I may have been reading that from a book. I got it from a book, History, and the book had the wrong information, because I don't know this. I know who Dayan Asher Feldman was, of English background, a graduate of London Jews College. He died 1950. Rav David Feldman, whose sefer I worship, died 1955. I had the pleasure of being close to him in my youth. He came from a Hasidic background. He headed to the Orthodox community in Leipzig and came to Manchester about 1936, and was the first Rav of the Frum community, Machzikei Hadat, which had been founded in 1928. So I want to thank Rav Lezer Reich, Rav Lezer Reich, who I believe he visited, he wrote a whole Sefer memoir, studied in Hebron, visited the Chazon Ish, visited all the Gedolei Yisrael in the early 1950s. So I want to tell him, I appreciate the correction, but I want to boast a little, my granddaughter-in-law is the granddaughter of the Manchester Rav. She's an Mustafa on her mother's side. So I have a very deep connection to Manchester. And let me tell you, Al Allah Yiddish Meidlach should be like a Vizaycha to such a, all my granddaughters-in-law, Mashehu Mashehu. Now, for those of you interested, gentlemen, the story of the mikveh with the ice is even much more than I said last week. My comrade Rabbi Yoshua Grunstein, should live and be well, sent me a whole article he wrote, and he writes beautiful English. He's my Talmud. His father was my Talmud. He, too, was machshir a mikveh in Nova Scotia with ice. And he gives you the entire story here. It's anyone interested in this halakhic problem, here you have it. Now, on that correction of Rakefet, that he called the first Lubavitcher Rebbe the Lubavitch and not Lyozhna Rebbe. Imagine, I would have said Lyozhna Rebbe, Shalom, Moshe. Imagine how many people would have said, who Lyozhna Rebbe? They would think it's Rabbi Deutsch in Borough Park I'm talking about. Anyway, then he went on to attack Torah Ramada, that if I'm a representative of Torah Ramada, you see how terrible, horrible, horrendous Torah Mother is, and then if it wasn't enough to rip the hell out of me and Torah Mother, which is fine, we're nobodies, he then rips the Rav apart, that his stories are Bubba Mises, and he goes after the story that Rakefet tells in the Rav. Here is a whole article, I couldn't believe it, that ripping that story apart, don't even mention my name. They quote Rabbanan telling the story, Rabbanan Soloveitchik, they quote the Rav telling the story. They quote Shulamit Maizim in telling the story, and they rip the story apart. Why people enjoy? So if the story's not totally true, it's allegorical, listen to Rakefet's lecture today, and you'll find out why you don't have to waste your breath ripping it apart. Once again, if anyone's interested, Alan, this is for you. The other attachment is Shosh Nogach Et Hapara, what I mentioned in the lecture. Well, I still, no correction, but I stand on my version as I heard it. Finally, if you're interested, my dear friends, Shnayim Ochazin, you have to take the other one too, those go together. Shnayim Ochazin Betalit came to life. It is headline news in the New York Times and everywhere else. Who knows what I'm talking about? Wow, you people, I can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. You're not up to date, nothing. Been licked up in a little bubble. My dear friends, have you heard of the Newport News Synagogue? I believe it's called Sheret Yisrael. They have ancient Rimonim that are worth millions of dollars. What is it? Silver, gold, and a museum was ready to buy it. And the Shevet Yisrael, the Spanish Portuguese synagogue of the Upper West Side, is demanding and declaring and got a show cause order in court. We are the owners of the Rimonim. You cannot sell it. And that issue is now up for grabs in the you've got to read the article. And they are very simple. They claim it because Newport News went out of business at a certain point. There was no Jewish community left in the 1800s. Newport. So thank you for the correction. Newport, you're right. Newport News. Must be a newspaper I picked up that read Newport News. Newport went out of business in the 1800s. It's all in the article. And the Spanish Portuguese synagogue became the guardian, took it over, kept it open, put in money, and then the synagogue rejuvenated itself when a new community of Jews moved in. So they claim they are the legal owner. So I got to tell you, it's going to be very interesting to see how this is adjudicated, because it's mamish shnayim ochazin betalit. And Alan, I have to apologize. My dear student, Dr. Alan Blau, is sitting here. You don't know who this man is, but I know him going back. His father, big Talmud Chacham, Talmud the Rav, Mechaber of Svarim, very close friend, closest friend of my own cousin, Noah Daniel. We go back many generations. So yesterday he came to class and he was astounded how few students sit in the room where the shir is heard, Baruch Hashem. So today I said it would be a little better, but you're absolutely right. Ich lieg dort tief tire in dread. One time in the kollel, everyone came to class. Today, my only explanation is it's gone on, it's a process. The Art Scroll generation, Schottenstein, as we say it, overwhelmed by Shas, Paiskim, Yoredeya. Who has time for a Kefetz Narishkeit? So I am proud of today, and I apologize for yesterday. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya! Don't tell Richard Joe. God, what a home for this lecture. I don't even want to think about it.
We apologize.